Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the final night of our five-part series celebrating the Brian De Palma thriller. Tonight, we discuss 1992's Raising Cain with author and critic John Kenneth Muir and De Palma's longtime editor, Mr. Paul Hirsch. Coming up next on Movie Geeks United.
Looks like she was put in the car when she was still alive and then drowned. Look at her nails. See how they're cut and torn? Looks like she was trying to claw her way out. You should see the expression on her face.
You know, I hate to bring this up, but you are married to the perfect man.
I don't know.
Car popped up out of Half Moon Marsh. A woman's body in it.
And he's becoming awfully compulsive with Amy. He doesn't just take care of her. He studies her.
What do we got now? Two moms disappear from the same playground.
You could get us all put away for good.
I have this horrible feeling that it has something to do with his father.
I did nothing. I don't even exist.
This thing you're doing means everything to the old man.
I won't hurt her.
She'll hurt you.
We gotta find these women now. I don't want to be walking behind any lousy coffins.
You've done with Amy!
I don't know where she is!
I do. You should never have gotten out.
Dr. Walheim!
You're nothing but a cheap hoodlum.
I am what you made me, Dad.
I know what you're going to do! It's a bad thing, and I'm gonna tell.
It was Bobby! He did it again!
That's my wife.
You thought we were together, didn't you?
I'm not gonna let that loving wife of yours sell you down the river.
Give me my child!
What do you think?
I think...
Hickory dickory dock. Cain has picked his lock.
Hey everybody, it's Movie Geeks United. My name is Jamie.
And my name is Jerry, and welcome to the last, if not greatest, night of the Brian De Palma Trivia Week, because tonight we're probably talking about his most insane film, I think.
I think so, too.
I said in 1992 that Lithgow deserved a special honorary Oscar for his performances in this film, because they're just so over the top.
He deserves to be institutionalized.
Definitely. But watching the trailer today,
right.
I haven't seen the film in a number of years. I don't know if I'd watch this again, because I bought and watched a whole lot of De Palma films when we did our tribute show a couple of years ago. But watching the trailer today, and this is so many people since this film have lifted from it. It's, you got to say, we all these people saying, oh, De Palma, we talk about the no respect. But so many, and big-name filmmakers have taken from this film that it's astounding to me that this film and this filmmaker doesn't have a higher level of respect where people aren't open and come clean about it. Because, I'm sorry, I saw a lot of, hip movies that took from this today.
Yeah.
I mean, and I'm not going to name any names, but they're out there.
Well, it's interesting because this movie has always been accused of being the most blatant ripoff in De Palma's career, lifting off of a lot of De Palma's movies, his own movies.
Why? Well, is it wrong to steal from yourself? If it works, why not?
Morricone does it all the time.
Yeah, I mean,
he's the best.
Tarantino does this. I mean, all the great directors do this.
There's a reason for it, and we discuss it with John. I mean, it is pretty obvious. I mean, the particularly the Psycho references, and then, you know, you have a touch of Untouchables there. You have a mm-hmm. touch of Dress to Kill there, the cross-dressing kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun. This isn't everything. I was telling someone on Facebook today. This is De Palma's Everything But the Kitchen Sink movie.
Yeah, no, it is.
It's great. Let me tell the audience what it's about. I could not. I try to write this plot description, and I was having a lot of problems with it. So thank you, Wikipedia. Here it goes. Dr. Carter Nix, played by John Lithgow, is a respected child psychologist. His wife, Ginny, played by Lolita Davidovich, becomes a little concerned when Carter takes time away from his flourishing practice to care for their 2-year-old daughter, Amy. Carter seems to be obsessively studying their child. The audience quickly learns that Carter suffers from a multiple personality disorder, and his multiples are Kane, a streetwise hustler, Josh, a traumatized little boy, and Margot, a middle-aged mother figure. Mm. Carter and Kane are killing young mothers to procure their babies and toddlers. And one day when their daughter Amy turns up missing, Ginny demands Carter tell her where she is. Carter replies that she is with his father, whom Ginny knows has been dead for years. His father, a highly esteemed doctor who has loomed large over Carter throughout his entire life, turns out to be very much alive and is using the kidnapped children for scientific research. So that, you know, that's as much sense as I can. The movie, you know, the movie is delightfully confounding through much of its running time.
It's obviously there's, you know, like with home movies, it's almost like a very deranged version of home movies. What he does with it, I mean, this is obviously, there is, you know, you read these things that with actors and directors and writers who claim that they don't put, there's nothing personal in their films. De Palma manages a way to put a lot of personal in his films. And that's another thing that I find his style so seductive, because, you know, there's the thing with the father. That's definitely right in a lot of his films. And I think it's beautiful. I just think it comes out so beautifully. And in this one, wow. What can you say?
Yeah. Well, let's play the interview with John to get a sense of what this movie it may be really about. John Kenneth Muir, our last night with him, he's been with us the past 4 nights throughout this series. And you can read about his books on film and television at johnkennethmuir.com. You can read his blog of film criticism, including all of his writings on the movies that we've been spotlighting this week at reflectionsonfilmandtelevision.blogspot.com. Here is John telling us all about his thoughts on Raising Kane.
I guess the last film is that we'll be discussing is Raising Kane, which Dress to Kill, I mean, a lot of these films deal so intimately with female sexuality.
Right.
And Raising Kane is really, as you describe it, I think, as a social satire on the crisis of masculinity.
I see that absolutely. I mean, if you look at context again, you know, historical context in the 1990s, and you watch Raising Kane, I mean, it's very clear that, you know, it's about this crisis in American masculinity. I mean, it was sort of post Mr. Mom. There was more equality in the workplace. More women were out at work. Reagan, you know, the cowboy, very alpha male president, had been replaced by his sort of underling who, you know, was always described as a wimp, George Bush, you know.
Mm.
Women served with distinction in the first Gulf War. There was this blurring of traditional definitions of gender and gender roles, and there were all of these sort of sex-based kerfuffles in the 90s, you know, the Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill situation. There was, you know, the Year of the Woman running for the, winning in the Senate in 92, I believe it was. You know, it was all these elements where traditional masculinity, you know, some people were saying, you know, that it was being threatened, that the culture was being feminized by, you know, by women's equality in war, in politics, in the workplace, all those things. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, I necessarily, you know, believe that we've been feminized or that it would even be bad that we were more feminized. You know, I don't have an opinion on that, but I think that's clearly the context underlining Raising Kane. And you've got this character, Carter Nix, who is really a milquetoast. And he's a psychologist, but he'll never be the alpha male that his father was. His father was a great psychologist. He's just a workaday psychologist. He's given up his job to stay in the home and raise his child, Amy. And even when he's having intercourse with his wife, you know, he has to stop and go check on Amy, you know, who might be having a nightmare. And it's clear that his wife, Lolita Davidovich in the film, you know, is very upset about that. And, you know, this idea that he can't be the man she wants him to be. She even has an affair with a much sort of more traditionally attractive, macho kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Carter, with his multiple personality syndrome, begins to invent other characters who address some aspect of that masculinity. He's got the bad boy part of him, the sibling, the brother. And then what I find absolutely fascinating is that the strongest, most powerful character in his, you know, multiple personality realm there is a woman, Margot. He literally becomes more of a man by becoming a woman at the end of the film, which is probably the ultimate statement on the crisis of masculinity in 1990s horror cinema right there. So, I mean, it's just a very fascinating film. And, you know, I think the scene that just blows me away in that movie, it's not just the ending scene and what it signifies, but it's the scene where the psychiatrist, played by Frances Sternhagen, Dr. Waldheim, I think her name was, explains basically the whole chaotic terrain of Carter Nix's mind from top to bottom, like in one unbroken shot while walking through like many layers of a police station, like going from the office level down to the lobby level and finally ending in the morgue. I mean, it's like a tour of his mind, and it's just astonishing. It's just virtuoso, hypnotic filmmaking.
I think it's this scene that they talk about, if I'm not mistaken. The people kind of dismissed it as a takeoff on what many consider the most kind of boring scene in Psycho, the explanation scene.
Right.
Yeah, where they always say that's the weakest scene that Hitchcock ever directed.
You bring up a brilliant point here, which leads into another, you know, really critical aspect of the film. The film, you know, I say form sort of echoes content, that's the important thing, is that the film is about a guy who can't live up to his spiritual father. It's Carter and his biological father, and Carter's father, the great world-renowned psychologist. But Raising Kane is made by the guy who can't live up to his spiritual father, or so people say. We keep saying he's the next Hitchcock, but then the critics keep disappointed by his next movie. And so it's like there's a self-reflexive quality here, which was part and parcel of the 90s, that it's about Brian De Palma dealing with the ghost of his spiritual father, Alfred Hitchcock. And so he's got to, not that he's got to one-up him, but in a way, by doing that scene that outdoes the scene in Psycho by, you know, quite a bit, he's proving he doesn't suffer from that emasculating psychological problem.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Well, there's also lots of elements. It's interesting. I'm not sure if I could verbalize it, but there's also lots of elements of his previous work in the film. And you could almost, you know, the baby carriage down the stairs and in the climax, and you could almost say, you know, I did this, you know, isn't this worthy of Hitchcock in a way, at mirroring the character wanting to be worthy of his father.
Right, exactly. That's exactly right. It's like him saying, I say this is Brian De Palma's thriller zenith in a way. Some of the other thrillers, you know, we may look at and say they're actually, you know, better films, but this one is the zenith as far as how he views them. It's like his master's thesis. He's like pulling in qualities from all of his other movies and saying, this is what I brought to the thriller. And does it or does it not outdo Alfred Hitchcock? I mean, I don't think there's any shame in that, you know, to say, you know, I think it does, frankly. You know, Alfred Hitchcock Alfred Hitchcock is great. I love Alfred Hitchcock. He's great, but he's also a product of his time, you know. And because De Palma comes at a later time, he gets to build on what Hitchcock did. he gets to build on what Hitchcock created. So, yes, we would expect him to be better, and I think, in fact, he is better. He's more canny. He's able to do things quicker. He's able to get his points across more cannily. He has more freedom in terms of the violence and kind of explicit material he can showcase. You know, Alfred Hitchcock was hamstrung by that in the 50s and 60s. Now, and by the same token, I say, you know, somebody could come along. I don't think we've met that person yet, but somebody could come along and take everything that De Palma has done and build on that and have the next generation. And in theory, that person should be better than De Palma and Hitchcock. Now, I don't think we've met that person yet, but I don't preclude the possibility. You know, and I don't think there's any shame in saying he's better than Hitchcock. He has some advantages that Hitchcock doesn't. Just the fact that he comes later in film history, where we have better technology, it makes things easier for him in some sense. What he can imagine, he can bring to the screen more readily than what Hitchcock imagined that he could bring to the screen. You know, special effects have improved. You know, cameras improved. We have the Steadicam. Hitchcock didn't get to use a Steadicam. You know, it's foolish and antiquarian to just say, you know, Hitchcock will always be the best, because that's, you know, he didn't have all the advantages. He was the best for his time period, and we still watch him because he's so important. But De Palma is very much the best in his time period as well. And like I said, that doesn't at all preclude the possibility that somebody else who synthesizes all this material will be the best of their time period, and that time period is still to come. For a while, I thought that might be David Fincher. I still hope it would be David Fincher. I could see how that may be possible. I don't know. We'll have to get further down in his career to see. Maybe if we're still around in 20 years, we can reconvene.
Yeah, he's kind of taken a different direction. I think it's great. He's not being pigeonholed by, which he could have easily been with Successive Seven. But some of his films are the work of a great novelist filmmaker in a way, I think.
Right, right. Very interesting. It's a very interesting. But you know, we always want to worship Hitchcock, and he's enormously. He's eminently worshipped. You know, he deserves to be worshipped. He's eminently deserving of such worship. But so is De Palma, because he took the next step. You know, and I'd like to see more people, you know, admit that.
Do you think that there will be a reassessment of him years from now?
Well, here's the problem with that. There should be a reassessment, I believe. Actually, he's my favorite filmmaker. I think he's absolute top. Nobody you know can orchestrate an action scene the way he can. No one can orchestrate this paradigm of form echoing content the way he can. But we live in a very different culture now than when Hitchcock wrote. We are so polarized in this culture, and as I said. De Palma has been tagged as a leftist. I mean, Bill O'Reilly and others on the right on Fox went after him big time about Redacted. The polarization of today's America, there's always going to be 50% of the people who refuse to sort of acknowledge De Palma as the master he is, because they're going to say he's a liberal. You know, his films are liberal.
Right.
You know, Hitchcock never had to deal with that level of polarization. You know, Hitchcock is universally praised. You know, you have to be a real contrarian, you know, to say that. But because of the times we live in, and unless this changes, and I don't see it changing, that, you know, De Palma is always going to be viewed through the lens of being a liberal. And so that as long as there are outlets like Fox and, Tucker Carlson, all those people, there's going to be, they're always going to paint him with that brush. I think. I mean, I think that's really unfortunate. But
and they're kind of simpletons that cannot recognize metaphor. You know, and essentially Redacted is in many ways the same movie as Casualties of War, and I think that's intentional, because his point is nothing's changed.
Right.
You know?
Exactly. Yeah. I totally agree. But and, you know, people say he didn't. You know, he wasn't respectful enough of the troops. You know, that he's not supporting our troops. And you know that's like the de facto argument.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, you say that, there's like going to be a whole swath of people that won't support you. You know, you don't support the troops. You know, and you know, it's just it's sort of a crazy kind of hypocrisy.
It's impossible to get out from under that kind of. You know.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, you know, the thinking is so narrow there. But I mean, as far as film critics go. You know, I don't know, because, you know, even film criticism has taken, you know, a very strange turn with the internet. I mean, I'm all, you know, there are great online critics. There are online critics that are fantastic, every bit as good as print critics. That, you know, television critics, the same thing. But there's just been this vast opening of the field, and we don't know really whose voice is going to dominate in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people just write reviews not based on the things you very clearly have enunciated in your interview with me, that you understand, the metaphors, the film technique, the form echoing content. They don't look at anything like that. They look at, well, what, did this movie entertain me? You know, did I like the story? You know, there's a whole lot of that substituting for criticism right now.
And
as long as that's the case, people are going to just go look at his movies and go, huh? You know,
we're losing the power of critical thought, and there's so little of it out there. I mean, you really got to sift through a lot of trash to find it.
Yeah.
You know.
And it's not, and you know, like I said, there are many great online critics. There are many great TV critics that, you know, so I mean, the voices are there, but it is harder to find them. You know, there are so many, you know, and every opinion on the internet is, you know, quote unquote equal in a way. So, you know, people who don't have training in film or who don't study criticism or who don't know much about history even, you
mm-hmm.
go into a De Palma film, and you're baffled, you know.
Yeah.
What the hell is this about? You know, what does it say? I mean, you look at Raising Cain, you don't know it was made in 92, and you don't know what was going on in the culture, and, you know, you know it's just Lithgow playing different roles, and in the end he's a woman, you know. But what does that mean? If you're not remembering what was happening in that era, you don't know what that means, you know.
Yeah.
You know, we're not equal. I mean, this sounds really terrible, but many of us are not equal to the films he's made. That sounds horribly elitist and rotten.
No, I think you're right. Yeah.
You know, but I think it's true. I think at this point, I think he's smarter than a lot of his audience. You know, in the way he creates films. Other people aren't making films in this mode except Tarantino.
Mm-hmm.
And Tarantino is popular, so maybe I'm wrong.
That's why I'm hopeful that the reassessment occurs and one day we catch up.
Yeah.
So where De Palma's been.
I'm saying I'm smart and everyone else is stupid. That is so awful. No.
It's clearly the truth. one last point about Raising Cain. I think a friend told me an anecdote that he read from Tarantino. After Raising Cain, Tarantino approached De Palma and said, "You must have been really burned by the reception of Casualties of War, and because Raising Cain struck him as a really pissed off movie." And it's even, as you point out, it's even inherent in the title, you know? He's
yeah.
raising Cain, he's gonna raise hell with this movie.
Exactly, and he does. He certainly does. I mean, it's a bracing film, but, you know, really all of his films are. It's like a strong wind hits you in the face because
mm-hmm.
it's so filled with ideas. And see, this is the difference, and this is the thing that I wish I could, you know, sometimes get people to understand, you know, who don't like his work. It's like, it's not just the ideas of his stories. Like, accept that and deal with what the stories are. It's how he expresses it. It's the ideas in his expression that are so important and so masterful. And that's why he's such a great artist, I mean, to me, is that, you know, how he expresses his ideas is so eloquent, it's so surprising, so lyrical, so poetic. I mean, you know, he's just great. He's just great. I you know, when I did that De Palma retrospective last year and, you know, rewatched so many of his films and reviewed them, I just realized this is the guy. For me, this is the guy. This is like the idealized film director for me. You know, he is really it. You know, because he's just done so many different kinds of things and he's done them all so well. And there is such value in his films. You know, even if you question, well, why do a narrative about, I don't know, you know, split personality. You know, well, why did Hitchcock do it? You know, but, you know, even if you value the narrative, look at how he vets it. Look at how he expresses it. It's just so daring. It's gamesmanship of the highest order, challenging us to keep up. And how, as a film goer, an enthusiastic film goer, can you not love that challenge? How can you not take that challenge, you know?
I feel the same way.
Yeah.
So I'm just so honored that to do these shows and to have you take part in them. You've given me almost 2 hours of your time.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
I cannot thank you enough.
Okay, that was your best. That was your best. That really
thank you.
Really,
I've been trying to unmute this darn line. So.
That's all right. It was really I would honestly have to say, and we've had a lot of great historians and film critics on, but that was quite honestly the best conversation. Not interview, that was a real conversation.
Yeah.
We had for 5 nights, and it obviously took place over 2 hours. But he said something very interesting before we go back to Raising Cain. He just said something very interesting. And it's not elitist what he's saying. I understand perfectly what he's saying. And I don't think it's elitist. Of course it comes across as that, but it's really not. But he said something very interesting about the Internet. There is this tendency, especially with the social networking sites, for people just to blurt out what they think and everything. And it's almost comes from the thumbs up, thumbs down culture, which is not a bad thing, but it's just like there's no thought given, nothing. I believe that you need to take a couple of days to think about it, even right. Go back and watch it again, regardless whether you liked it or not. And he's right. I mean, he brought up a lot of great points.
Well, the Internet's changed everything. And, you know, the time to think about something, that doesn't exist anymore for critics either, because they know that hundreds of other people are going to jump and get online before they do with their reviews. And, you know, so right after screening, they have to run to a computer and type up their thoughts, you know, and there's
yeah.
no time to digest.
And you need to digest it, especially something like this.
I mean, look, we're talking about movies during this series 30 years old
mm-hmm.
that we've watched dozens of times.
Yeah,
and we're
yeah. mm-hmm. and we've had that
rediscovering
time.
Things about
yeah.
them.
God, you know, one of the dumbest things I ever did, and I know that's like that, there's a whole book of those, but one of the dumbest things I ever did was try to write something about Inland Empire after one viewing.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
the dumbest fucking thing you could ever do. it's really interesting. He there's really good points he brought out about the time that this movie comes. I didn't even think about George Bush, you know, the wimpy, you know, because remember, he had that whole the wimp thing. I mean, I think Peggy
yeah.
Noonan wrote an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal, the wimp image. And that, and also if you look at the films that came out at the time, this came out around the same time as Single White Female, Unforgiven, A League of Their
mm-hmm.
Own. So it's a very mm-hmm. interesting time period it comes out to.
You're right. It's really... It's really about, yeah, just what he said, the changing role of the male and female.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and this was made about the time that those roles were changing. And,
right. Mm-hmm.
And it's about the father figure, both
oh, yeah.
literally in the film and you know, his relationship with the Hitchcock heir, as
mm-hmm.
we discussed in that conversation.
Yeah, and that was a good point about Fincher. I thought
yeah.
that was a very interesting name to bring up, and...
I think that Tarantino is the modern heir of De Palma.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean,
both in terms of tone and in terms of how he kind of giddily takes from other sources and then puts it in a pot and makes his own stew with it, you know.
Yeah. No, you're right.
But it's interesting.
It is
that you mentioned Lynch. Because this is
why
part
did
of the,
that? Because that's always one of the dumbest things I've ever done.
I've been reading John's criticism of some David Lynch movies, and he's got a review of Inland Empire and Firewalk with Me and a few other
mm-hmm.
Lynch projects on his blog there. And one of the complaints about this movie is similar to the complaints about Lynch when he did Wild at Heart, which is my favorite Lynch movie.
That's an watershed movie for you too.
Yeah, very much so. And the complaint about that movie was, it's Lynch doing Lynch. The complaint about Raising Cain was, it's De Palma doing De Palma. You know, in returning to this genre. Yeah.
Is that wrong? Now, in Lynch's case, I think it was too soon to... Because what we have the Twin Peaks series right before Wild at Heart came out the end of that summer. So we have that. We have Blue Velvet. And we have Dune. And then before that, we have The Elephant Man and Eraserhead.
Right.
But I think that's too soon. See, there's something very interesting about Wild at Heart.
Well, that came on the heels of the first season phenomenon
first season
of Twin Peaks, too.
Yeah, but it's yeah. But this is very important to bring up is about Wild at Heart is it was based on, you know, Barry Gifford's books. And Barry Gifford, and I thought it was... very interesting. It was always like David Lynch has always had this like film noir kind of thing, and it was a very neo-noir kind of film. And I think you can, there are some, obviously, there are some characters and there are sequences that are very Lynchian, but it's also, he's taking, you know, he's going beyond Blue Velvet. He's taking the mystery and all that and going further, I think. I actually think of all the films you're going to go at, that's not the one I'd do, to say that.
Yeah.
That's just me, though. That's my own obligation.
Here's a review of Raising Cain from Owen Gleiberman, and this illustrates what we brought up about Lynch and De Palma doing De Palma. From the Raising Cain review on EW, when a director begins to cannibalize himself, rehashing the themes, moods, and visual devices that have become his trademark, it's usually a sign that he has gone creatively bankrupt. The more slavishly he imitates his own work, the more he slips into the muck of self-parody. But what do you say when a gifted director cannibalizes himself on purpose, reveling in his most notorious excesses, transforming his own shamelessness into the basis of a joshing and ardently trashy style? And what if the very gimmicks he's recycling have already been swiped from an earlier and extremely famous source? Of course, he's talking about Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm.
And the lurid and gonzo Raising Cain, writer-director Brian De Palma, doesn't just rip off Alfred Hitchcock. He rips off himself ripping off Hitchcock. He rides over the top of self-parody into a kind of Looney Tunes reflexivity. And it's not... But what is he getting at? What is he exploring with that? I mean, there's a reason for it. It's not just I'm sick of this. I'm just gonna do a completely copycat film. I'll copycat myself. I'll answer those critics. You know, I mean, yeah, there might be a little bit of a response to criticisms against him, but
I think what Tarantino said about Casualties of War, but also I think it also was the reaction to Bonfire of the Vanities.
Sure.
There's some of that in there. I mean, you see that's not unheard of at that time, because Coppola in The Godfather 3 actually takes a direct hit at Paramount. The character on Don Lucchese is actually named after Gary Lucchese, who obviously Coppola must have had a hard time with. Did not think very highly of him either. But you see this as a very after watching Bonfire of the Vanities, which everyone had high hopes for, and then, you know, it fizzled on every level. You know, these guys, all right, great. And they didn't like Casualties of War. Bonfire was a mess. All right, I'm going to go back and do what I do best.
Right.
And I
think
that's the most important thing. I think it is one of his most personal films, but I think he wants to, like, there's almost like a thing, like him saying, I do this, and I do this better than anyone else alive.
Yeah.
Kind of when he makes a movie like Raising Cain. And more power to him.
And there's always a sense of kind of defiance in a lot of Brian De Palma's movies. He's defiant. I mean, he sees things the way he sees them, and he's making the movies that he wants to make, using the devices that he wants to use.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you don't like it, here's another movie with even more in it.
Yeah. I mean, it's just something he does. He does very well, and I hope to actually see another movie along that's so manic, so crazy. I'd love to see another film like that. I hope the Black Dahlia was not that film. I'm kind of hoping he still has some more tricks up his sleeve. And
well, I guess this is a good time to bring it up, since this is the last show of the series. Toyer is what he's doing now. I think he's in Italy prepping it. And they're going to shoot it very, very soon. And I guess he thought long and hard about it for many, 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 many years, and he says that he found a very unique way of shooting it.
Mm-hmm.
Here's something from De Palma a la Mode about it. It's material based on a book and a play by Gardner McKay called Toyer. De Palma's film is based on the play and not the book. People have been trying to do it for decades. It's a very intensive psychodrama between two characters. but no one's figured out how to open it up and make it work as a movie. This is a quote from De Palma. I got an idea how to do it, and I pulled it off the shelf last year and adapted it. No, it's not. It's not from De Palma. Yeah, it is.
I thought that was from him.
It took us quite a while to obtain the rights to the material because Gardner died last year and we had to deal with the estate and his widow. Finally, they were able to work out a deal. De Palma calls it a very terrifying piece of material. It's been terrifying for over 30 years. Talk about a return to the form that we know and love him for. This could be it. Toyer. I'm giddy at the prospect.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is better, I guess, than the Boston Strangler movie, although I would like to have seen that, too.
I would, too. I hope that still happens, too. Here's a quote from De Palma that pretty much describes a lot of the concepts we've been discussing in relation to this and other films. De Palma said, I've dropped myself into straightforward character pieces in order to explore that form and reap its values, but you are sort of restricted visually when your first requirement is to tell a fairly straightforward story. So Raising Cain is probably his least straightforward story.
Right.
But he's just loving what he can do with it visually.
Right. No, you're absolutely right.
Another thing with Walter Hart, another correlation to that. I like Wild at Heart as my favorite Lynch movie. I don't think it's the best movie Lynch has done. I think the best movie Lynch has done structurally is Blue Velvet.
Mm-hmm.
And I also love Fire Walk With Me. But Blue Velvet is like the fence post there. Wild at Heart I love because it's sloppy, it's crazy, it's delirious, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the tone is set for that from the very beginning. Anything goes in that movie, and you'll accept anything.
Yeah.
If it was a neat movie, if it was packaged and neat and you know, a really tight script and all of that, it wouldn't work like it does.
Right.
Raising Cain is the same way.
Mm-hmm.
It's a go for broke movie.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I guess one of the reasons, I also am a big fan of Lost Highway.
Right.
I like that because it's also him and Barry Gifford reuniting, and there's parts of that film I just find they're absolutely wildly beautiful. Okay, sorry, we'll go back to De Palma now. I just wanted to bring that up.
Yeah, and, you know, in terms of technical bravado, that is the most jaw-dropping tracking shot in Raising Cain.
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm.
Throughout the police station, into the elevator, down a long flight of steps, down to the morgue. It's just great, you know. And it's how he, if it mirrors the most boring scene in Hitchcock's career from Psycho, or the most, you know, savage scene of his career, then it does so just on surface. I mean, the woman's explaining everything about Carter and his personality defects and blah blah blah. But De Palma one-ups it because the camera is just so expressive. It's just a big stunt that
mm-hmm.
you're just amazed and glued to it. You know, the information might be mundane, but the visual stimulation definitely is not. And that's
no, there's nothing mundane about his visuals. Nothing
yeah.
whatsoever.
The psycho thing. The I mean, it's clearly.
mm-hmm.
Take off a psycho when he puts her in the back of the car and pushes the car in the lake there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, and he one ups it by having her pop out and start screaming. It's one of the biggest jumps in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's another thing about this movie. It is so much fun. You jump out of your seat and scream. I mean, the very last shot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I remember the audience just screaming.
Yep, they were. Mm-hmm.
And then he ends it. He's like, "All right, that's it. See ya."
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take listener phone calls. If anyone wants to call in and share their thoughts on De Palma, any of the films that we've discussed, you'll have the opportunity to right after our final interview of the night. This interview is pretty long; it's 45 minutes long.
Okay, cool. This
yeah.
this should be fascinating because we didn't we try to get him
many times. Yeah.
This is a big deal, guys. So please, this is big.
This actually took me making a phone call to get him.
Okay. Wow. Okay.
Instead of an anonymous email.
I listened to the whole goddamn thing. this is rare.
I work my ass off punching those 10 digits. Let me tell you.
No, dude. This is if you had to do that, dude. This is big. I can't wait.
Paul Hirsch, longtime De Palma editor, started with him very early, almost from the beginning. He learned editing by cutting his teeth on De Palma films. Also, famously, he's worked with John Hughes on Ferris Bueller's Day Off and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and most famously, with George Lucas on Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back. Talk about a legend in the editing business. And, of course, his relationship with Lucas blossomed because he had a relationship with De Palma. I mean, his career really grew because of De Palma. Raising Kane, he edited, along with many other great De Palma films, Carrie, Sisters, a lot of them that we've been discussing in this series, Blowout. Here he is talking about the art of editing, talking about his time and impressions of De Palma, the working relationship he had with him, and then we discuss a little bit about John Hughes at the end of it. Here's Paul Hirsch. The editors tend to be very meticulous, intellectual, very focused. What was it about your sensibilities that drew you to film editing, do you think?
I studied art history at Columbia College, and I went to take a degree in architecture subsequently. But it was another bachelor's program, and I wasn't really prepared for another 4 years just to get another bachelor's degree. So around that time, there were a number of things that, you know, I don't think there was a single thing, but my interest in architecture was something that turned out to be remarkably similar to editing in a way. And then I had been to, in getting my degree at Columbia, I had been to a summer program in Paris. And Paris, as you know, is, you know, the cinephiles' capital.
Right.
And there were little art houses all over the city, especially in the Left Bank in those days, showing American films. And they would say, Raoul Walsh Festival. And I had never heard of Raoul Walsh. And I became interested in the French fascination with American directors. And during that time, there was a festival of Orson Welles films at the Cinémathèque at the Palais de Chaillot. And I went, and in 1 week, I saw Citizen Kane, The Magnificent Ambersons, The Lady from Shanghai, and Touch of Evil. And on Friday night, they were showing Othello, and Welles himself came to speak, and you couldn't get near the place. And I had never seen any of these films before. So I was kind of enthralled with movies. At around that time, a friend of mine was editing a small documentary in his apartment on West End Avenue. And I visited him, and I saw for the first time editing equipment, splicers, rewinds, a moviola. And this was in the 60s, so this was pre-videotape.
Right.
And the only way you could see a moving image in those days was in the movie theaters or on television live. There was no tape. There's no replay of anything. The only way you could see a moving image was forward at sound speed. So here was this machine where you could go forward, you could go backward, you could stop on a frame, and I was thunderstruck. I thought, oh my God, what a fantastic tool. And I had always liked working with my hands, and I was drawn to it for that reason. And I left architecture school and got a job in the business.
And you met Mr. De Palma fairly early through your brother, was it?
Yes, my brother Chuck, Charles, was at Universal. He had been a manager of the Garrick Theater in Greenwich Village next door to the Bleecker Street Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd been recruited into a sort of junior executive program at Universal Pictures on Park Avenue, 45th Street. And they were, I guess they were further up, they were in the 50s. But anyway, Universal was constantly being approached by New York filmmakers looking for financing for their projects. And my brother was put in charge of scouting young directing and writing talents. And in fact, I think he was just there as a lightning rod to deflect people away from the other executives. You know, they never, I don't think they really intended to do anything with walk-ins off the street. But some of those walk-ins were, you know, people who became important directors later on.
Yeah, absolutely.
So and Brian was one of those walk-ins, and my brother, Chuck, tried to get Universal to finance a film directed by Brian, and they would have none of it. So during a two-week vacation from Universal, he raised money independently and produced and co-wrote with Brian a picture called Greetings, which starred Bob De Niro, among a couple of others. It was a story of three young men trying to evade the draft, or avoid the draft, let's say. And it was in 1968. It was the height of the Vietnam War and the height of the anti-Vietnam movement, and, you know, an earth-shattering year in American history.
Yes.
And so they made this film, and I had gotten a job by that point. I had worked my way up in various small jobs, and had gotten a job as an assistant editor at a trailer house. And I was starting to cut trailers. And when Greetings was finished, Chuck came to me and had me cut the trailer for it, which I did. And Brian and I met, and we kind of hit it off. And when Greetings turned out to be sort of a minor hit, they got money from the financing company, a company called Sigma 3. Oh, they were the distributors, Sigma 3, to do a sort of a sequel, which was originally entitled Son of Greetings. And then we changed the title to Hi Mom.
Yeah.
And it was the further adventures of the character De Niro had played in Greetings. And that was the first film I edited. I was 23 years old and didn't know anything, but didn't know I didn't know anything.
Yeah, that's a wonderful time. I had just a general question, because you entered the industry at a time when movies were changing, and that you were speaking about visiting France and awakening to movies there. The European influence was really showing up in 70s cinema, and I'm curious, how did that reflect in the editing style of the time?
Well, you know, I think editing is a nonverbal language, and as such, it crosses international borders easily. So you can see influences from American films traveling east across into Europe and other, you know, things that they do coming west. I think editors watch films. We get ideas from other people's films. We get ideas from our own work. You know, it's sort of a process of accretion, where things are picked up and utilized and become standard, and then people make, you know, we stand on the shoulders of all the editors who've gone before.
Mm-hmm.
I remember seeing Breathless, and I didn't know anything about editing, but I was excited by the film in ways that I didn't fully understand. And I had the pleasure of meeting Cécile Décugis several years ago in France. She was the woman who edited Breathless.
Uh-huh.
And it was quite interesting talking with her.
The first entry that De Palma had in the thriller genre really is Sisters.
Uh-huh.
And I'm curious to know a couple of things about that film. And one is the use of split screen, which De Palma does quite a bit. And
right.
If I'm not mistaken, you're not so crazy about split screen, are you?
No, not really. I mean, I find that, you know, it's an intellectual device rather than an emotional device.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think it takes the audience out of the movie for a moment. you know, while it's on. It's fascinating, but it distances you from the characters in the film.
Yeah. It was obviously shot and conceived to utilize split screen, correct?
Of course. Yeah, he had simultaneous cameras in the scene where the victim, I forget his name, Philip is the character's name. Philip crawls to the window and scrawls on the window in blood, and Jennifer Salt is across the way and sees him. That moment was shot simultaneously from inside the room where he's writing on the window and from Jennifer's point of view.
Right.
So, and then when the police arrive and Dr. Breton is trying to make his escape, there was shots in the hallway, shot simultaneously, where they come out of the elevator, he ducks around the corner, and then they go by, and he, you know, he crosses from one screen to the other. It's very successful, I thought.
Mm-hmm. And when the film gets progressively kind of loonier as it goes on, it's terrific. Did you work to make your editing reflect that? Was there a different pace that happened in the editing as the film went on?
No, you just respond to. See, I was still, you know, look, I was 26 when I did Sisters, my second film. Very different from High Mom, which was sort of one sketch after another, basically. Kind of a loose story. I mean, the script for High Mom was, you know, three or four pages on a legal tablet. You know, that was Ryan's outline, but the whole thing was sort of semi-improvised.
Right.
Whereas Sisters was scripted and in many instances covered in a way that films are conventionally covered, with wider shots, tighter shots, and so forth. And, you know, I was still feeling my way and learning. I had no one to teach me editing. I sort of had to discover it on my own, which was an experience actually I shared with Walter Murch, who said he had the same experience, that he had never been taught either, and discovered the rules by working and making mistakes and correcting it and seeing what works as opposed to what doesn't work. And in effect, the experience of doing that was sort of like gave me the feeling that I was inventing editing, even though it had already, you know, I was reinventing something hundreds of other people had, you know, thousands, if not thousands, had already discovered. But having to do it myself and reinventing it myself was very exciting.
Well, you're finding your own voice in that art form.
Yeah, finding my own way, yeah.
Yeah. Is it difficult because you're so close to it and you live with the footage for so long? Is it difficult to maintain a fresh perspective to truly know if it's working?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the process is such that once you get something working, you stop paying attention to it and you focus on what's not working.
Mm-hmm.
So that your focus is never, your focus is constantly changing, because the things that work start to outnumber the things that don't work, and then eventually everything's working as well as you can make it. And then you focus your attention on sound effects or music or color or, you know, other aspects of the finishing process, as opposed to just strictly looking at it from an editorial standpoint.
Right. You after Sisters, you did Phantom of the Paradise and
yes.
Obsession.
Yes.
For De Palma. Was Obsession really a breakaway from the style of those earlier De Palma films, the way you cut it?
Well, it was shot in widescreen. Vilmos Zsigmond was a cinematographer, and Vilmos is a genius. I mean, the stuff is extraordinarily beautiful. And it was my first experience cutting a widescreen movie. And, you know, when CinemaScope first came in the 50s in Hollywood, they would shoot everything in masters and hold everything for a very long time, because they thought, well, it's a big screen, it's a lot more to look at. So the style of the photography changed to more masters, and, you know, and group shots as opposed to close-ups. And the editing style reflected that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So when I started cutting Obsession, Brian had not particularly made any of those, you know, sort of 50s-like choices. He shot it as you would other films. And I cut it. My sense of the pacing of the film is always derived from the tempo that's established by the action. So I wasn't thinking in terms of the tableau and, gee, I ought to hold this longer because it's a big screen.
Mm-hmm.
So I just cut it according to my own, you know, my own feeling about the pace based on the action and the pace of the dialogue and so forth. And whether I want to be on somebody delivering a line or if the reaction to that line is more significant than the person delivering the line and so forth, the choices you always make. And when I first saw it projected, I thought I had this moment of terrible anxiety that everything looked too short. That, because I was seeing it on the big screen, and I thought, oh, my God, this all could play longer. You could look at this stuff longer. And then, and then I decided, no, it was fine. I got over the anxiety and I looked at it again and more rationally and I thought, no, this works fine. About that time, Jaws came out and Brian was friends with Steven Spielberg and he often came to the editing room. And I said to him, you know, it was interesting watching Jaws because it was shot in widescreen, but it was cut no differently than you would cut a, you know, 4x3 movie for television in terms of the pace. You know, but it didn't slow down to accommodate the big screen.
Hmm.
And Stephen agreed. He said, yeah, you just cut it like any movie.
When you become involved in these projects with the De Palma films, do you come in at the pre-production stage? I mean, do you have the script and invest in the script before they start shooting, or at what time do you come in usually?
Well, back in those days, you know, we were all very young, and yeah, I would get, you know, copies of the script beforehand, but no, I was not involved in pre-production in terms of casting or any of those other, you know, physical considerations. But, you know, I'd get a copy of the script, and I'd give Brian my comments.
What, with Blowout, particularly with the editing, I would think that would be a particularly challenging project because so much of it, articulates the process of filmmaking as well, and the syncing of the footage with the sound,
right.
And you see all of that working.
Right. Well, that was fun. I mean, it's interesting that now that that's all obsolete, it's become a sort of a document, a sort of a historical record of filmmaking techniques of the previous, you know, century.
Yeah.
We didn't realize that at the time that it would be, you know, like that, but it was very much influenced by. Those scenes were very much influenced by Blow Up, you know, Antonioni's
mm-hmm.
Blow Up, where he was in the dark room and, you know, making successful greater enlargements and so forth. And even the title, you know, when Brian, I think the original title of the film was Personal Effects, or maybe that was my idea for the title. But anyway, when he said we're going to name it Blowout, I kind of groaned because it was so obviously derivative of Blow Up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Brian has always been, you know, vulnerable to the charge of plagiarism.
What is your take on that? Because, I mean, I've asked the previous guests about this that we've had for the series. The Hitchcock comparison always comes up.
Well, in point of fact, I think actually Brian and Hitchcock are very similar in terms of their personalities. They're both drawn to the dark side. They have they share a kind of sardonic wit,
mm-hmm.
and they're very visual. And I think those things are not. I mean, they're similar to Hitchcock, but they are, you know, in fact, genuine with Brian. Those are genuine aspects of his personality. So, of course, he's going to be influenced, you know, and interested in film, he's going to be influenced and drawn to somebody who's so similar to him as a person.
Right.
And I might add, you know, slightly sadistic as well.
Yes.
So all those things, the wit, the dark humor, the, you know, the visual flair and the kind of, you know, sadistic quality, and a fascination with women in peril, you know. I think all those are shared by both men, and, you know, just Hitchcock came first.
Well, with Carrie,
yeah.
When you're talking about women in peril, mm-hmm. such a strong female characters in that film, and the film works because you so empathize with Carrie White.
Right.
So when it all goes to hell at the end, it truly is horrifying.
Right.
And you... Any discussion of De Palma, it always focuses upon the sequences.
Right.
And, of course, the big one in Carrie is the prom
right.
Sequence.
Right.
What can you share with me about building that sequence and making it work?
Well, the prom sequence breaks into two halves. There was a long build-up to, you know, the key moment is when they dump the bucket of blood on Carrie. So preceding that moment is a long, extended section where all the elements are put in place. There's a long tracking shot which starts with one of the students collecting ballots, and then she goes around to all the tables collecting ballots for king and queen of the prom, and then she goes over to the door, she kisses her boyfriend, they swap the ballots. When you see this, all this is all in one shot. And she takes the fake ballots, which have, you know, been rigged so that Carrie wins the election, and she takes him over to the teacher's desk, and then the camera comes down and we see Nancy Allen and John Travolta hiding under the bandstand, and then there's a rope in Nancy's hand. We follow the rope and it goes around the stage, and we see I think we see Amy Irving on the side there, and then the camera cranes up and we follow the rope, and then the camera winds up directly over the bucket. And you can see the blood in the bucket, and you can see the microphone where they make the announcements from directly below the bucket. And then the camera tilts up and zooms back in to the table where the shot originated. So that's one single shot that establishes the geography and the layout of all the characters. And then there's a long slow-motion sequence when Carrie's announced as the winner, where she walks up to the stage. And that... I think in that slow motion sequence there were about 100 setups.
Wow.
So, yeah. And then once she gets the blood dumped, then slow motion ends and chaos begins. And that's at that point, Brian introduced the split screen.
Right.
Well, when the studio saw it, they did not like the split screen. And he got a lot of resistance on that. And he sort of said to me, look, you know, give them what they want. You know, just, he was disgusted and disappointed. And he said, just, you know, fix it. So many of the shots that he had shot in that sequence, he did not protect half the frame. I mean, he had intended it to be split screen. So half the frame would be, you know, something interesting. And the other half would be light stands and, you know, filming equipment that, you know, he hadn't bothered to keep out of the frame because he never intended to use it. Some of the shots were protected for the full frame, and I was able to use, you know, so I used as many of those as I could. When there was no way around it, I had to go with the split screen.
So his choice would have been to use the split screen that entire section of that sequence.
Yes.
I know that you feel that it's more of an intellectual than an emotional technique, the split screen, but why do you think he's drawn to it? Is it kind of economy, that you see her point of view and then you see the havoc that she's causing on the other half of the frame?
I think Brian is just fascinated with being able to see two points of view at the same moment.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like... you can see it from this direction, you can see it from this direction. You know, the nuances of psychology are not his strength. His strengths are visuals and camera movement and choreography and things of that nature, in which the actors are the object of the camera, you know, movements and setups. And these set pieces that he designs are giant mechanisms that are not derived from human psychology, but in, you know, very often the human behavior is made to fit the design that he's come up with.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, in a picture that I didn't edit, the Vietnam picture with Michael J. Fox, Casualties of War.
Yeah.
There's a sequence where they're putting a bomb underneath a latrine or something. And I remember watching the film, and Michael is trying to strike a Zippo lighter.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the timing requirements, he has to do it much longer than I thought any real human being would have given up. You know, he strikes it. He would have, you know, thrown it away and looked for something else to light his cigarette with. But that's a small thing. But very often, the character's emotions are seen in rather, or depicted in simplistic terms.
Right.
The exception is when you have a great actor, and he has had many great actors in his films. Carrie, for instance, I think, you know, Sissy Spacek evokes sympathy automatically. I mean, she's just an extraordinarily sympathetic character.
Yeah.
But many of the actors whom Brian has discovered, you know, like Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio, and he was an early proponent of John Lithgow, and I think Charles Durning was, you know, first film was Hi Mom, I believe, and many other wonderful actors that, who have been in his films have really done their best works, have done their best work in other people's films.
Mm. The music, because
yes.
when we discuss those sequences like Carrie,
yeah.
I mean, you think of Pino's music,
right?
At what point does that come in, and do you edit to tailor the score at all? How does that work, that process?
When you're editing the film, when I'm editing a film, I often use music to give an indication of how I think the film will play when it's finished. So you resort to existing film scores or classical music or whatever to fill out a temp score or a scratch track, however you want to call it. And then the composer will screen the film with this temp score accompanying the images, and it gives them an idea of what the director and the editor are thinking about in terms of what the finished score has to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
So then they use that as a guide, and they write their own music, turn the emotions expressed in the temp score, they turn that around and express the same emotions but in their own language, in their own idiom, with their own notes, hopefully.
Right.
But for instance, the scene at the end where Carrie, you know, the famous moment where the hand comes shooting up out of the ground, the temp score for that was the Albinoni Adagio for organ and strings, which is the saddest music I could find for Amy Irving laying the flowers on Carrie's grave. And then I found a deliberately arrhythmic moment. I mean, I lined the music so there was an arrhythmic moment when the hand shoots up out of the ground. And for that, I used the main title from Sisters, which starts with an anvil strike.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sharp metallic sound just at the moment when the first rock is dislodged. You know, it starts to move and the hand comes shooting out. So you have this soft, sweet, sad organ and strings interrupted at a very unexpected moment by loud anvil strike. guaranteed to startle anyone.
Yeah, yeah. It is a startling sequence. That sequence
So Pino just copied that.
Yeah. That sequence is shot. Is it performed? Is it shot backwards? Or what was
One of those shots was shot in, or a couple of those shots were shot in reverse to give it a dreamlike quality.
Mm-hmm. How does De Palma shoot? Is he very specific about following storyboards? When you get the footage, is there a lot of options, or is it pretty straightforward how he wants it placed
together?
Well,
it depends, you know, certain, like, the shot I described from the prom, it's very obvious that's meant to be what it is, you know. Certain shots are designed such that they could only be used for one purpose. Other choices are not immediately apparent. I was working on the Fury once, and I was in New York, and he was in California. And I got this shot in dailies, and I didn't quite get how I was supposed to use it. It was a close-up of Amy Irving's hands scratching the arms of the chair she's sitting on.
Mm-hmm.
And I called him up and I said, Brian, I'm a little unclear about this shot. And he said to me, you're the editor, you figure it out. And he hung up on me. So I figured it out, you know. I used it as I saw it, and he liked what I did. So sometimes it's obvious, sometimes it's not. But Brian was always very supportive of my work. He was my champion early on, and it was through working on his films that I became, you know, known to George Lucas, who offered me the work on Star Wars.
Yeah.
And Brian was very supportive and instrumental in my getting that job, and I can't thank Brian enough for everything he did for me and the stuff that we did together. We had a great time working our way up.
Yeah. Before I let you go, I just want to ask you, any recollections or thoughts on the process of putting together Raising Kane?
Right. Well, Raising Kane was a puzzle for me because at that time I was working at 20th Century Fox. I was sort of the in-house film doctor at the studio, and I'd been doing it for about a year, and I was not happy with the job because basically the job is turning terrible pictures into bad pictures. I mean, and that really wasn't fun for me. I wanted to be working on good films. I mean, that's my whole ambition in life, is to work on good projects. And even though there were certain perks of being, you know, inside the studio, and I got to see, you know, Daryl Zanuck's personal steam room and all that, you know, but in fact, the work was not fun. And at that point, I was working on a picture where the director really didn't want me, and my services were not welcome, and I was eager to get out of there. And I got a call from Brian's agent, and he said, Brian needs help. And I said, okay, I'm there. You know, so I told Fox I was leaving, and I flew up to San Francisco where they were cutting the picture, and I read the script on the plane. I hadn't read the script yet. And I read the script and I thought, what? Huh? What? So I got there and I looked at the film and I said, Brian, I don't get it. He said, look, it's very simple, you know, and he starts explaining it to me, and I was still puzzled, you know, because I thought, what? Because, you know, in the film, woman dreams about dreaming and then wakes up and dreams that she wakes up in the dream, but she hasn't woken up. It's part of the dream. So, you know, I said, is this, I don't get it. Is this a dream? Or, you know, and then he had titles, you know, Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. And I thought, what? You know, I don't know. It was just, I guess I'm a very literal person. So anyway, part of what we did was to straighten out the chronology a bit.
Right.
Because it was just, when I first saw it, it was moving forward and backward. It was just totally mystifying. I just couldn't figure out what was going on. So But he said, boy, if my own editor can't understand that, I must be in trouble. It was fun, you know. The film has that sardonic De Palma humor in it.
Yeah.
And we were editing in a guest house in Woodside, California. It was winter. We had a log fire in the editing room, and I was still working on film in those days. And to keep himself amused, Brian would bring books to read, you know, magazines and books to read while he sat behind me. And I remember at that point he was reading a book that was an instruction guide to how to commit suicide. I forget what it was called. And he would read aloud from it to me while we were working. And I remember he was saying, you know, here's a good one. You take a lot of sleeping pills and put a plastic bag over your head. This is how he would entertain us while we were working.
Wow.
I love working with Brian. It's very enjoyable. To go back so far, it's.
Yeah. I recall seeing Raising Cain when it was released theatrically.
Uh-huh.
And like the zinger at the end of Carrie, the one that comes in the last shot of Raising Cain, I have rarely heard a reaction like that from a crowded theater. It just screams.
Oh, great. When Lizzo appeared?
Yes, and it left you on such a high, like, uh-huh, when you left the theater.
Uh-huh.
It's terrific. I do love that picture.
I've heard that, not a lot of people, a lot of people had problems with the idea of stealing the children, you know, kidnapping children. But we used to say, and there was a catchphrase that developed around the editing room, which, have you spoken to the others? You know, that line that Lizzo delivers. Oh, no, it was Bill Finley.
Yeah.
Have you spoken to the others? You know.
do you attend? Do they have screenings, or is the screening process important for you to gauge how a film's working?
Yeah, I mean it's easier with a horror picture or a comedy because you get vocal reactions that you can evaluate. I remember when we were screening Carrie, we had screenings at the MGM screening room in New York, and all the seats in the theater are sprung, that you can lean back in them, you know. And Brian and I would sit in the last row when that hand came shooting up out of the ground. Every seat in the theater recoiled as everybody stiffened, you know, and we'd laugh, you know. It was so funny to see every seat in the theater go back at the same moment. But, you know, in comedies you can gauge where the laughs are. That's very important.
Right.
But in a drama, you know, like a picture like Ray, which I edited, you know, when the picture's working, you can't hear anything. I mean, the best response is no response.
Right.
In a drama, everybody, you know, sits there like quiet as a pin, you know. So I think screenings are most useful for, like I say, films where you can hear or experience the response by the audience.
Yeah, an audible reaction.
The kind of testing that they do out here of asking questions about this and that, I don't know that it's terribly useful.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about movies now. I mean, what do you think the state of film editing and movies in general, where that lies now?
Well, the state of editing is, I mean, the digital tools that we have now are extraordinary because it gives you so much freedom. You can do so many extraordinary things and have so much control over what you're doing compared to working on film. I mean, I can, for instance, when I was working on Ray, I would do these multi-layered montages of, you know, various layers, one on top of the other, and I could do it right in the Avid. And I could control what, you know, exactly what frame, if I was going to do an iris, I could control where on the screen the iris would close down and how fast, and, you know, control that. And, you know, on film, you'd have to send it out to an optical house and wait a week and get it back and tell them what they did wrong, you know.
Right.
So working on the Avid is extraordinary. The problem is I once wrote a little article for one of the editing magazines out here called How the Avid Made the Work Easier and the Job Harder. Because the Avid, because of its speed, makes the editing process interesting to people with ADD, with, you know, who are executives and so forth, people like that, or to be more charitable about it, people who are have very busy schedules and don't have a lot of time to focus on the editing process. When it was on film, they wouldn't stick around because everything took so long.
Yeah.
With the Avid, everything is so immediate that, and you know, the big screen we now cut on, you know, 42-inch plasma screens, and instead of a, you know, 5-inch, you know, or Steenbeck is a, you know, 18-inch screen or whatever it is. Now there's a big screen. Everybody can sit back on the couch and talk about this or that. You know, it invites people into the process.
Right.
Which is, I think, deleterious.
Mm.
But, you know, for the practitioner, it's great. But in terms of the sociology of it, it's not great.
Right. Well,
and the films, you know, today are just really depressing. I mean, the films that Hollywood is making is just, you know, it's demoralizing. Because they're not making the kind of films they made even 10 years ago. You know, they tend to make, you know, bland comedies or
copycats of everything I've seen.
You know, comic book adaptations of comic books, comedies, and big action, you know, franchise films.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they make the films for the audience that they can most easily manipulate.
Yeah.
Through advertising. So, it's kind of depressing.
But
people like me who like good stories, you know. I find the foreign films to be more interesting today than most American films.
Yeah.
You know, there are always exceptions. I thought The Kids Were All Right was very good.
Well, the Source Code is the movie that the last movie that you've been working on.
Yes.
The new Duncan Jones film.
Yes.
And he's a really exciting filmmaker.
Yes.
as evidenced by Moon.
Yes.
What are your feelings about this project?
I have high hopes for it. I think it's a really fascinating, you know, I think excellent cast, a great story, and we'll see how it plays.
Well, I look forward to seeing that, and I just want to, you've had such an incredible contribution to films, and so many of them are very close to my heart, so I just want to thank you for bringing those to me. Thank you so much.
You never even mentioned John Hughes.
I didn't. I was going to ask about it, but you've been so great with me, giving me this much time. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is my favorite Hughes film, one of my favorite comedies, and I really
Most
do want to
talk about Ferris.
I do like Ferris, but I find that I return to Planes, Trains most often.
Interesting. That's a whole saga in itself.
Planes, Trains? Oh,
yeah.
I did have a question about Planes, Trains because.
Yeah.
I was contacted by someone that they wanted to see. Apparently, there's an hour of extra footage that wasn't placed in the final cut that hasn't been made available. It's in a vault somewhere, and so I said that I would ask you about that.
Oh, I'd love to see that. We the first cut of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles was 3 hours and 40 minutes.
Wow,
and. We screened 12 reels, stopped, had sandwiches, and then we screened another 12 reels. And at the end of it, John turned to me, he said, "It's too long." I said, "I know." So we went through it on the first pass, and we took out 1 hour and 10 minutes, just like that. We just threw it out. It was like almost a third of the film. We just out.
Hmm.
And we worked another 3-4 weeks, or 5 or 6 weeks, and got it down to 2 hours. And we previewed the 2-hour version, which we thought was hysterical. And the audience did not agree.
Huh.
And I would love to see a copy of that cut if it existed anywhere. But, you know, we didn't have tape in those days. I mean, I guess they had tape, but it was not... we didn't have tape in the editing room. It was all film, you know, so you'd have to send it out to get a videotape. And it was just, he may, you know, John, you know, I have to ask his sons if they ever, one of them contacted me after he died and said he was going to call me when he got to L.A., but he hasn't called. But I mean, to ask him if there's a copy of that cut in his possession. But that was, I thought that was a terrific cut. But then eventually, we previewed the picture 9 times. Because with a comedy, you can tell where the laughs are and where they're not, you know.
Yeah.
And we kept cutting and cutting and cutting and cutting. And, you know, the running time now is, what, 90 minutes, I think.
So it was just a question of getting it as tight as possible to make it work, or?
Well, that was part of it. And the other half was that it's a character comedy. And, you know, interestingly enough, the smallest thing can make a huge difference in a character film, you know, whether it's a character dramedy, a character drama, or a character comedy. The smallest thing can turn an audience around about a particular character.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that in our original cut, Candy was perceived as a user. He was taking advantage of Steve. And so they didn't like him, and then they lost patience with Steve for why did he, they thought, why is he staying with this guy who's just using him?
Mm.
And it took us 4 screenings to figure that out, and we put back a line that we had taken out, something where he offered to pay for something once. Oh, let me pay for that. No, that's okay. You know, and that was it. Then they liked him.
Huh.
It was the smallest thing, but it turned everything around. It was quite amazing.
There's a cut in that film that I love, and it's Steve Martin. I think he's after Candy steals the taxi cab, he sees him again. He's trying to place where he remembers him.
Yeah.
And there's a quick cut to John Candy looking through the taxi cab door window.
Yeah.
And yet the door is somehow separated from the taxi cab.
In the airport.
Yes.
In the airport lounge. Yeah.
Right. I love that movie.
There was a shot of Candy in that airport lounge where Steve, you know, they raced to get to the airport and then the plane is delayed, so they're just sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
So they're waiting and, you know, I forget what's in the film anymore, you know, because I've been through so many versions. But at one point he takes off his shoes and then Steve reacts to the smell of his feet or something. And he's watching Candy, sort of trying not to look at him, but he can't help it, you know. At one point, Candy is eating a chili dog and smoking a cigarette at the same time. And he takes an enormous bite of the chili dog. No, first he takes a drag on the cigarette, takes a deep drag on the cigarette, and then he takes a bite of the chili dog and blows smoke out his nostrils while he's chewing the chili dog. Which is fabulous, but
that is great.
I don't know if that made its way into the final cut. But.
What kind of guy was John Hughes? Because I mean, he was—I mean, so little is known about him. We did a show on him and interviewed 5 or 6 people that had worked with him. But in your experience, what kind of collaborator was he?
Well, he's the funniest man I've ever met in my life. I mean, there were days I couldn't work because I was laughing so hard. He would get on a roll. He would start telling a story, and then you know, an hour would go by, and he would just embellish and embroider and. And I would just be in tears, you know.
Mm.
And at the same time, he was sort of mercurial and moody. And so he was extraordinary. I mean, his writing is extraordinary.
Yeah.
And it's a loss. But he never liked Hollywood. He hated Hollywood, and he hated the interference by studios. And getting creative notes, he couldn't stand that.
Right.
So finally he had enough money, he just said, screw it, and he went home.
Did you have any interaction with him when he left the business in those years?
No.
No.
I saw him once in the early 90s when I was doing that job with Fox where I cut a picture called Dutch, which he produced.
Right.
So I saw him then, but that was the last of it.
Okay, that's Paul Hirsch. Got a little off topic there, but it's a worthy discussion of John Hughes.
That's definitely worth it. That was incredible. I mean, as I said in the chat room, it's probably the best best interviews we've ever done, especially you that you've ever done. I mean, this has just been gold. I mean, on
yeah.
levels, but just fantastic.
I'm very, very pleased by the turnout for De Palma among the guests and and our listeners too. I mean, our listeners have been posting things, and we have players up on websites. Mm-hmm. And,
it's been incredible.
They really come out in force to support us and to support
De Palma. Thank you. Thank you to everyone who's really supported this whole week and all the shows.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
It's funny, when he first when he first read the script to Raise a Cane, he was like, huh? That's great. Okay, we're ready to take your calls. The phone number, the call-in number.
We're not screening these calls either, so please.
Yeah. 718-508-9477. So we'll give a couple of minutes to see if we can get some phone calls in here, and then we'll welcome your thoughts on De Palma. Right now we have, I believe, A Taste for Blood, that's a screen name, on the line.
Okay, cool.
Taste, are you there?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, and it's A Taste of Blood. But yes, it's me.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm so sorry, man.
That's okay. My name is Ryan. How do you do?
Great. How are you?
Hey, Ryan. Nice
to meet you, too. Thanks so much for doing this De Palma week. I mean, I'm a huge De Palma fan, and as you could probably tell in the chat room. And so it was just a treat for me to hear all these interviews and, you know, especially for Blowout, because there's no DVD extras for that movie, so
that's right.
any extra information I can get on that movie is great.
I agree with you, man, and we even talked about that he is not represented as he should be on special edition kind of DVDs. Is Blowout your favorite? What's your favorite and why?
Well, my favorite movie is Carrie. It's my favorite movie of all time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know when I realized that it was my favorite. It just dawned on me that I just love this movie more than anything else. And so I've seen it so many times, I could practically recite the whole movie watching it, you know?
Yeah.
And but I do think that, I mean, that's my personal favorite, you know? It's the one close to my heart. But I think maybe his masterpiece is Blowout, I think, in terms of just sheer cinema. That movie is hard to beat, I think.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, we agree with you on that. Yeah, definitely.
So have you seen pretty much all of De Palma's stuff? Is he a director that you definitely follow?
Yeah, I do follow him, but there's a few I haven't seen. Some of the later ones, like the non-thriller movies, like Wise Guys, I still have to watch. I still have to see Mission Impossible and Bonfire. But I've seen most of them.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not really any that I don't really like except for Redacted, which I pretty much hated that movie. I can't really find anything good to say about it. I understand what you guys were talking about earlier, saying that it's the same movie as Casualties of War because he's saying nothing's changed.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like that movie is just so inferior to Casualties of War. I mean, mm-hmm.
I agree with that. Yeah.
Casualties was so gripping and emotional, and I just didn't really feel anything for anybody in Redacted. And I just wasn't feeling it.
You know, another thing that's missing from it, and Redacted is an interesting experiment for him because he's playing with all these different media, and that's exciting to him. But I miss the visual kind of showmanship from Redacted because it's pretty statically done.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't, you can watch it and not see that it's a De Palma film, in a way, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's not representative of his movies. I mean, you can always, you can't mistake a De Palma film, usually.
No, definitely not. I just wanted to, like, mention a few movies that weren't really talked about.
Please.
This week. Well, I love The Fury.
No,
I think that movie's so underrated.
Mm-hmm.
I did mention it in the chat room, the escape sequence from the Institute. That scene is just fabulous. Mm-hmm. And I think also that movie has one of John Williams' most underrated scores.
It's a great score.
Yeah, and so that, I don't know, and the ending, of course, John Cassavetes blowing.
Yeah, blowing up, and not only does he blow up, he blows up like 10 times. They do like 10 different cuts on it. That closes the movie. I love John Cassavetes as an actor. He was a
fascinating actor.
A great presence on screen, and he was great as that evil guy. We were going to do The Fury, and we just didn't have any luck getting guests for that particular movie. Another movie that we haven't even mentioned is Carlito's Way, which this is interesting because, I mean, throughout the years they've done polls on what's your favorite De Palma movie on the internet, and Carlito's Way keeps moving up and up and up. So as it stands right now, the last poll that I saw, Blowout is number one, and Carlito's Way is number two in an Italian poll. And Carlito's Way is like number four or something in an American poll.
Right.
A French poll, I think.
It's a good, I always thought Carlito's Way was like almost in some ways better, a much more mature and better version of Scarface.
I think Scarface is, when you talk about the one-dimensional characters in some of the De Palma movies, intentionally so, I think he's making a point about that in Scarface.
Mm-hmm.
Carlito is like a different monster altogether. I think
it's also just a really balls out performance, great performance from Pacino and especially Sean Penn. I mean, it's really, you could argue, Sean Penn's movie.
Yeah,
I think. But it's really, I always enjoyed that one. The first time I saw it, I was like really blown away by Carlito's Way.
My problem with Carlito's Way, Pacino's my favorite. My problem with it was always that the story's been told so often. You know, the criminal that gets out of jail and he tries to fly straight, and the influences won't let him. But what's exciting about it, as in all of his movies, is that De Palma's directing it. You know, it can't help but be unique because it has that visual flair to it.
True.
I remember it.
I have to agree that Carlito's Way, I love that movie, and I think it is better than Scarface. Although I do love Scarface too, I can't deny that. But I watched Carlito's Way for the first time I think last year, and I was blown away because I. You know, his later movies aren't as well-remembered, I think, and so I wasn't expecting much out of it. But it did sound interesting, so that's why I watched it. And, you know, is the ending. I love the ending. I know it's sentimental, but it gets me every time, that song, the Joe Cocker song.
Exactly, yeah. I think it's a good movie. Look, that train station sequence. Here's what's great about that train station sequence. And I'll we have other callers on the line. I'm gonna get to you guys in just one sec. He was supposed to shoot elsewhere. I forgot where he was supposed to shoot that scene. And they pulled it at the last minute. They pulled the permits or something, and so he had to improvise a different location. And when you think about the power of that scene, that whole sequence, where they're chasing him and through the train station, that's an amazing accomplishment, especially when it was done more or less on the fly, if I got that right. And Pacino is a great action actor. I mean, you read so much into his eyes that he's a really underrated actor of action, and that scene is a perfect illustration of that. And the pool table scene, where he's looking at the open door, and he knows somebody's in there, and they're probably going to attack him, and he's got his eyes on everyone, and yet he's trying to concentrate on the pool table so he doesn't let on that he knows what they're up to, and it's got breathtaking sequences in it, like all the Palma movies.
That's another great scene, I have to agree.
Yeah, absolutely, man.
I'll get off the line because I know there's other people. So thank you so much for having me on and talking
and
to Palma.
Thank you,
Ryan, and we really appreciate your support throughout the series, and we hope you come back often.
Yeah.
Thanks, I intend to.
All right, buddy. Bye-bye
right,
now.
Thank you.
Talk to you later. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 717 area code. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah,
yes.
Hi. I'm on line 2. Noel Vera.
Oh, hi, Noel. How are you?
Hi, how are you doing? Is Paul Hirsch still online?
He is not. It was a recorded interview we did with him.
Sure. Okay, I didn't understand that. But yeah, just wanted to say, yeah, I'm a big fan of De Palma too. One that doesn't, I agree with Carlitos Way, and I'd say, gotta be kidding. I mean, that what you're calling a cliched story. Call it like, you know, the last moment gangster, last chance redemption thing. Call it like an armature, like a basic premise on which to take off on operatic sequences.
Right.
The kind that flies, right? It's opera. Carlitos Way is basically visual opera. And I rate it higher than The Godfather. Hey, call me heretic.
I won't call you. I won't call you heretic, man.
Think about it.
You know.
It goes to show that we've been talking about it throughout the week. All of De Palma's movies are operatic, and it goes to show you that a director can take a piece of material that, on the surface, might have been done many times before, and make it sing. You know, in a way that you've never experienced.
High Sierra, for crying out loud, High Sierra, or. Public Enemy, that's an old story. And when you think about The Godfather, it's an old story too.
Sure. But so would you rank Carlito as your top De Palma?
Oh wow, Blowout is such an old favorite.
Yeah.
Blowout. Yeah, you know, it's your it's his Vertigo. I know he's a big Hitchcock fan. Blowout's the heartbreaker, but Carlito's climbing up there, absolutely.
Yeah, without a doubt. Yeah. Without a doubt.
And
no,
I'm
I'll
not sure if anyone... Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, please, finish your thought.
I'm not sure if anyone mentioned Mission to Mars, which Paul Hirsch also edited.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned it because it's the one that people rarely talk about, and I've been arguing that people really need to look at that one. People need to rediscover that big time, because it's a very hopeful movie, which makes it stand out automatically in De Palma's resume. And I just thought it was gorgeous.
The hopeful part I have problems with personally, but this is where De Palma, the science geek, really comes out, because it's second to 2001, you really can't think of a more scientifically accurate science fiction film.
Yeah.
Hard to find out. And there's that sequence there, that extravehicular sequence where they're out in space and they're trying to do a rescue, where it really captures the hopelessness of zero gravity. If you make a mistake when you push off, you don't get that moment back. It's lost forever. That really drives home that sequence, that kind of hopelessness that, you know how action sequences, they all happen fast. This is really slow motion in real time, paradoxically.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah,
that's
without a doubt.
Sequence. Nowhere else can you find that kind of action sequence, right?
Yeah, I agree
that's
with you.
Great, and a lot of his so-called failures. What do you call that? The one with the drill body double.
Yes.
I think it's terrific.
Body double has a lot of people love body double.
Yeah,
it's really
love body double. Great.
More and more as the years go by, I've heard more and more raves about that movie, but you're right, it was absolutely butchered when it came out by people.
It's ridiculous. It's like Raising Cane's ridiculous, but again, visual opera. I mean, there's a suspense of the characters trying to come out all right, and there's a suspense of seeing if De Palma can pull the sequence off.
Yeah.
He's doing like a visual somersault through the narrative. And if he lands on his feet, fantastic. You applaud on top of the fact that the characters come out all right or whatever.
I agree. And I think that he is one of those directors, and 937 I see on the line, we're about to take your call. I think he's one of those directors where he should be polarizing, you know, because he makes movies on the edge. And if he weren't polarizing...
it would take away a lot of the personality from his films, I think.
Sure. He takes risks all the time. He's not a good director. He's no, if you don't mind my saying so, pardon my French, Ron Howard. And the one everyone's like down on so much, the what's his name? The Black Dahlia. I think it's really, really underrated. That deserves re-examination, really. I think that's a great noir.
Yeah. I'm ready to re-examine it. I don't think I got it when I first saw it. I mean, I'm not ashamed to say, but a lot of De Palma movies, as we've been discussing, pay off so much the more and more you see them.
You rediscover
things. And I'm looking forward to reinvestigating Black Dahlia.
I'll let you go now. You go ahead and switch on to the next. But, hey, it's been fun talking with you guys.
You too, man. Thank you so much.
Sure. Okay. Bye.
Good night, buddy. Okay. Thank you, Noel. 937 area code. You're on.
Hey, Movie Geeks?
Yes.
Thanks for the Brian De Palma series. It's been really
You're
fun.
Welcome, man. What's your name?
Oh, it's Rich. Yeah, she's...
You're welcome, Rich. Thanks for calling in.
Just unknown voice. I've really followed De Palma for a long time, and it's just no one really seems to talk about him. I don't really get it. And he is important. He's, like, probably one of the top 70s directors, but I think even, like, going up to now, I mean, I think he's still maybe not as relevant with some of the films he's been putting out, but... I think he's good, and I mean, there's like barely any books on him or anything. Which
yeah, you're right.
Sad.
I've only read the book of interviews that come that's a series of directors' interviews, and I read like a pocket guide. And there's another book we interviewed an author a couple of years ago who wrote a book on De Palma, right, Jamie?
I think maybe a French book or something. It's almost like a Hitchcock Truffaut type of deal, but it never came out over here.
There's actually a French book that is just now coming out. They just announced it. It's part of a series where they focus on a specific film and director, and this one is on Mission Impossible. And it looks like a big book full of gorgeous photography and writing. But the only problem is I think it's in French.
Well, yeah. Which I took years of French classes, and I could probably tell you like two French words. But... Yeah, it's just, I don't know, because even reading that Easy Rider's Raging Bulls, I mean, he just got the shaft out of all those guys. And I think later saw some interview with Peter Bart where he's like, you know, out of all the directors in here, you know, De Palma, who cares, right? Like, oh, man.
Well, who cares what Peter Bart thinks? He's got his own issues.
Well, that's true. I mean, that book was, some of it was
what,
good.
Why do you think that is, Rich? Why do you think he's been shortchanged?
Well, I think you guys have brought it up before. It's basically just, you know, the genre that he's known for, thrillers, even though really, honestly, in the past, I don't know, 20 years, what other than Raising Kane, most of them haven't been thrillers.
Mm-hmm.
But then I guess the ones that he's done since then haven't been, you know, haven't gotten as much notice maybe. But I don't know. I like Carlito's Way. I think that's my favorite movie that he did.
And after that, he did Mission Impossible, which is probably his highest grossing film as we...
Yeah. And I love Snake Eyes. I know that's the one. I think everybody has a De Palma movie that they love that everybody else seems to hate, but that's the one that I really
like. The opening
like.
Tracking shot's awesome in that film. That whole...
Oh, yeah.
That's an awesome sequence.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the cinematography for that film just puts it... You know, up there. I mean, I know it definitely has some story problems, especially at the end, because they had to reshoot the ending and everything. But and even Black Dahlia, I like that one. But it's sort of, I don't know. I understand why people don't like it, but I love film noirs. I mean, it's basically a film noir that was made in 2006, but you know, with some violence and sex, and it was in color. But I mean, it plays like the acting and everything. It's like straight out of noir, but...
Yeah, but it has all the great De Palma touches in it. I mean, it's not perfect, but it's a fun... I won't lie to you. I had a lot of fun watching it. I mean...
And I think maybe if people read the book before, which I didn't, I could understand, because from what I understand, like, the book's like this big epic and everything, and...
Right, but I will say this.
We're going...
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go, please.
Oh, I'm
talking about the book.
I was going to say, I think people were expecting it to be like L.A. Confidential, like shot in that, because, you know, that was shot in a more realistic style and the acting was more naturalistic. And, you know, they were expecting from the trailers, like Zodiac or something. And,
yes.
You know, that's not what it was at all.
No, not at all.
Go ahead, Jerry.
Okay, I'll go ahead. But it's like the perfect union, the perfect marriage of source material and director, though. I mean, that's what's heartbreaking about it. It doesn't fully work. But, I mean, if there's ever a writer and a director meant to work together, it was James Ellroy and Brian De Palma.
Well,
I mean,
I always wanted to see him do a noir. It was like, you know, Carlito's Way, in a way, is somewhat noirish, and even Scarface. It was just like, you know, I always wanted to see him do a noir. And, yeah, I mean, it's definitely not perfect without a doubt. I wouldn't claim that, but I think it got crapped on a lot more than it really should have.
So before we let you go, Rich, let me know, tell me what your favorite is. Tell me which one you hold closest to your heart among his resume.
Well, it's Carlito's Way, but I think that actually may have been the first De Palma film I ever saw, so, I mean, that may be why, but it definitely Carlito's Way. I like Carrie, Body Double, Casualties of War, Untouchables. I mean, I like his stuff that isn't thriller, and I think a lot of times people, they kind of disregard it. And I think really the films that he's done in the last 20 years, those films barely have anything written on them. I think that's where like the writing and stuff needs to be done in the future because they do need to rediscover other stuff too, like Blowout, but yeah, I mean, there's barely anything written. Like, even Mission to Mars, I mean, I know you were talking about that, and when I first watched that, I thought it was terrible. I thought, man, this is, like, the worst thing you've done. Like, this is worse than Wise Guys. But, yeah, I mean, it's watching it now, like, knowing, like, okay, he was just trying to do basically a flat-out 50s sci-fi movie. You know, this is what it was. He wasn't trying to make it, you know, really like the sci-fi movies of today, you know, because it was probably what he grew up with, so kind of like a throwback. And yeah, it is like, it's a really kind of spiritual movie, and you know, that's not what
exactly. It is surprisingly spiritual, and it's kind of deep on it's deep on a level that isn't your typical, you know, space and we're going to fight Martians kind of movie. And plus it's delicious kind of notion that De Palma did a Disney film.
Yeah.
Hey, David Lynch did too, so around the same time.
Yes.
So.
Yeah,
the
Straight Story.
In the air, I don't know. Straight Story. But anyway, thanks, guys. And
no, thank you.
I'm glad, because what I usually do is I listen to your guys' show when I'm at work doing computer work. So it kind of gets me through the day sometimes. So thanks, guys.
Hey,
I appreciate
you.
It so much. Thank you, buddy.
All right.
Take care.
Bye.
All right, intelligent listeners, intelligent callers, Jerry. Congratulations, we got them.
I know, we got them. We did it. We really came through this time.
You guys are all great. Thank you so much for calling in. Thank you for joining us all this week. We love De Palma. Our featured show this week, and it'll be changed out next week, is our interview with Brian De Palma around the time of Redacted. We interviewed him, and we interviewed basically the entire cast of Redacted on the same show. And a show previous to that is another tribute we did, just a general tribute to De Palma. And that show had William Finley in it, Armand White, and Eyal Peretz, who actually wrote, as you were talking about, Jerry, a book about De Palma. So obviously we're crazy about De Palma. And De Palma heard, just to share this with the De Palma fans out there, he heard our tribute show to him from 3 years ago. And we found out about it because a journalist friend of ours was at Toronto where he was premiering Redacted. And he was also a guest on the show. His name's Keith Ulick. And he was in a roundtable interview with De Palma, and De Palma looked at his name and said, "Were you on with the Movie Geeks on that show?" And he said, "Well, yes, I was." And he said, and William Catt was supposed to be a guest, and he never responded back to us to confirm after he initially agreed to come on. And De Palma said to Keith, he said, "William Catt ever show up?" So that was exciting for us. And I think based on that first tribute show, he thought we were okay, and he agreed to come on our show.
Yeah.
So we hope if Mr. De Palma's out there listening to these shows sometime, he feels our affection for him and our appreciation of his great body of work, and everyone's appreciation that all the callers and all the people that have listened to the series. It's definitely out there, and we can certainly feel it.
Definitely.
And we wish him a happy birthday. He turns 70 tomorrow.
No sign of slowing down.
No,
awesome.
We don't want him to slow down.
No, God, no.
So, Jerry, it's been a great, enjoyable ride.
Yes, it has.
Great, great conversations with great people. We're so proud that we could bring them all on the show. Sunday night, we'll be back. Nicholas Meyer, director of Star Trek II, so many great movies. The Day After, yeah. So we'll be playing that interview on Sunday night. And next Wednesday night, it's trivia time. Name that film score. These are fun shows.
Yeah.
Where we pit two composers against each other and play a kind of name that tune game with film scores. And the rivalries are born. It's exciting stuff.
It's very high spirited, very exciting here.
Oh, it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. All right, so speaking of film scores, let's close out with another Pino from Raising Cain, okay? Pino Donaggio.
Sounds good. Good night, everyone.
All right, buddy. Good night.
Good night.